The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening on this week's program.
What is it you want, Barry? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
We find out how the film It's a Wonderful Life became a Christmas institution. We also go back 170 years to the beginnings here of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. And we hear a letter to Santa that dates back to 1933.
The mother, on maybe reading her son's letter to Santa, decided instead of posting it to Santa that she would post it to the Lord Mayor.
As well as that, we bring you a roundup of films for the history buff on the telly over Christmas, and we hear about the biggest storm to hit Ireland. Could history repeat itself? Plus, on the centenary of the World War I Christmas truce, we separate fact from fiction. And that's where we begin this evening.
1914 on Christmas Day. On the Western Front, the guns all died away. And lying in the mud on bags of sand, we heard a German sing from no man's land. He had a tenor voice so pure and true. The words were strange, but every note we knew. And soaring o'er the living, dead and damned, that German sang of peace from no man's land.
Brendan McQuail singing Cormac McConnell's song about an almost mythical event in World War I. More from Brendan later. In December 1914, World War I had been raging for 4 months on the Western Front. The fighting had reached a stalemate, with soldiers from both sides encamped in cold and muddy trenches. On Christmas Eve, something extraordinary happened. Soldiers set aside their weapons and their hatred and came together to celebrate Christmas. Lorcan Clancy tells the story.
In the weeks leading up to Christmas, the weather had been mild and wet. In the early hours of Christmas Eve, this gave way to a hard frost. Temperatures dropped below freezing, producing a dusting of ice and snow along the Western Front. At dawn, lights began to appear. It took the British a few minutes to realise what they were. The Germans had placed hundreds of Christmas trees, decorated with candles, just outside their trenches. At first, the British thought this was some kind of trick, but then the sound of singing floated across no man's land. The Germans sang Still Nacht. The British responded with the First Noel. Slowly and cautiously, soldiers emerged from the trenches and met in no man's land. They talked, bartered for cigarettes, and exchanged souvenirs. The atmosphere was one of holiday rather than conflict. This unofficial ceasefire was a chance for soldiers from both sides to bury their fallen comrades. In a few areas, football matches between German and British soldiers were played in the middle of no man's land. Officers on both sides disapproved of the ceasefire and took action to ensure that it couldn't be repeated. Never again would these soldiers lay down their weapons and greet their enemies as friends. Just 6 months earlier, they could never have guessed that this temporary truce would be their highlight of Christmas 1914.
The 1914 Christmas truce has become something of a legend, and when events become legends, the details can become exaggerated. I'm joined by historians Katrina Pennell of the University of Exeter and Paul Rouse from UCD, who are here to separate fact from fiction. Paul, what certainties do we know, or do we have any certainties at all? Because I have seen this disputed by so many historians so often.
I think the certainties are that there was a truce in a certain area for Christmas Day and possibly a little bit longer than that. But along the Western Front, there were very many places in which there was no truce. And certainly along the Eastern Front, there was no truce. What happened during that truce, again, is a matter of conjecture. And if you were to look at the Sainsbury's ad, for example, on British television at the moment, you would imagine that an event that took place in a certain area at a certain time happened all along the Western Front. And there is no sense of that. But there is a certain evidence that there was a singing of songs, that there was a football kicked around, although this has kind of grown into a match between England and Germany, which the Germans won 3-2.
In front of a crowd of about 50,000 in a proper stadium, etc., etc. Yeah.
It's where myth and history collide in the story of the truce.
Katrina, did they play football, for example? Was there a football match, or were there impromptu kick-arounds, or did footballs feature in no man's land at all?
I think Paul has set the scene very well, really, and this emphasis on sporadic moments of fraternisation between British and German troops along the Western Front. And Paul's absolutely right to point out that it was in certain places. Perhaps one of the most famous places was in what Tommy's referred to as Plug Street in southern Belgium. But yeah, I mean, as Paul says, there were kick-arounds. There was the presence of footballs or impromptu footballs hastily thrown together, whether that was bags stuffed with something to replicate a football. But this idea of it being a monolithic match all across the Western Front, you know, this 500-mile front line is really, really problematic and has begun something of myth and legend, particularly in British popular memory of the war.
We think of it in terms of fraternisation between British soldiers and German soldiers. Was there fraternisation, for example, between French and German soldiers, do we know?
I believe there's less evidence to suggest the incident occurred between French and German soldiers. My understanding of the event at the time is that it was something far more common between British and German troops. And I think we can understand that perhaps in terms of French soldiers fighting on home soil. You know, they were literally defending their land. So the idea of fraternization between them and their German enemy is perhaps more difficult for the barriers of enmity to be broken down.
How long did, Katrina, how long did it all last? Are we talking about something that really happened over a few minutes? Did it happen over a few hours? What was what were the durations involved here?
My understanding is that moments of fraternisation began on the 24th of December, which is the day that Germans traditionally celebrate Christmas, with the holding up of candles, with renditions of Christmas songs. But really, it was over, I would say, within a matter of a day or so. And certainly by January 1915, this was an event that was being reported as something of an anomaly. So it was very, very short-lived. I mean, you've got to remember, and I think it's really important to emphasise this, because the Sainsbury's advert, for many reasons, is problematic, but perhaps most problematic because it's suggesting that war is about peace and fraternisation. War is not about that. War is about killing and not being killed yourself, and it's a very bloody, horrific event that this Christmas truce perhaps turns into something more humane and cuddly.
Could these soldiers have been court-martialed?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look at it from official military legal terms, this was fraternisation with the enemy, which was as bad as desertion and accusations of cowardice. You know, this was undermining the British war effort. So it happened with officers turning a blind eye or perhaps getting involved themselves, but this was not something that would have been endorsed at, official central levels.
I think Katrina's absolutely right, and she's completely correct when she reminds us that war is about death. And there is something utterly cynical about the Sainsbury's ad. I mean, it is, after all, an ad, of course, and there's something cynical about most advertising, but it makes the war look beautiful. There are no rats eating dead bodies, or there's none of that portrayed inevitably in a Christmas ad, which is meant to be warm and fuzzy. I think there's something really interesting here that is not portrayed in the ad, and that is the burial of the dead bodies, which is part of the truce that people are found. One of those things that was spoken about. It's also a simple fact that wherever that truce took place, and we know this from some of the letters, the men who were observing a truce could hear the guns booming further along the front, places where regiments were continued to fire against each other, and that shouldn't be forgotten. So I suppose the crucial question is, how has it become so much of a myth? How has it grown so much? And of course, I think it's rooted in that desire for people to find some glimmer of hope, some glimmer of normality, some glimmer of humanity amidst such appalling suffering.
Okay, let's hear the middle section of Cormac McConnell's musical take on the truce. So let's hear some more from Brendan.
They left their trenches and we left ours. Beneath tin hats, the smiles bloomed like wildflowers. With photos, cigarettes, and tots of wine. We built a soldier's truce on the front line. Their singer was a lad of 21. We begged another song before the dawn. And sitting in the mud and blood and fear, he sang again the song all longed to hear.
Brendan McQuayle there, thank you very much indeed. We'll hear the conclusion of that song a little bit later. Let's hear this eyewitness account of the truce, a letter written in this instance by an Irish soldier at the front.
Letter dated 6th of February 1915. My dear mother and pap, now to tell you the story I put off. We went into the trenches again on Christmas Eve. It was a hard, cold and a clear night. About 7:30 p.m. the German lines were lit up by numerous lights, which turned out to be scores of candles on Christmas trees and all burning brightly. Following the appearance of the lights, the Germans began singing as loud as they could. We listened for a moment, and not a shot was fired by either side, and not even for many hours afterwards. The Germans were making happy the festival, and why not we too, thought some of the fellows in my trench. And there and then they started singing ragtime, and one or two Irish ones such as Come Back to Erin. The more we sang, the more so did the Germans. Next morning, a couple of hours after daybreak, one of the Germans shouted across four times, "A Happy Christmas, English!" I did not hear any of our chaps returning the compliment. I guess that's why he shouted four times.
And you can understand why there would not have been a response to Happy Christmas English. So there were Irish songs, Paul, being sung in the trenches during the Christmas truce.
Yes, there were. And there are many letters and memoirs which refer to this, including one from David Williamson from Tyrone, who talks about how on that truce arranged between the British soldiers and the Germans on Christmas Day, how the regiments to left and the right kept firing spasmodically all day. But that where he was stationed, officers and soldiers went across and they and the Germans exchanged tobacco and sauntered between the lines of trenches. And he writes in his letter, "It was the queerest sight in the world to see two lots of men who a few hours previously were intent on killing each other and will be again tomorrow, but now were talking together as if they were the greatest friends." And he goes on to talk about how they even arranged a football match between them. And then he writes about how later, he's writing this letter on Christmas Day, and he says, he finishes his letter by saying, "Since I started writing this letter, a telephone message has come through to say that the Germans had won by 3-2. Now, this is no doubt somebody writing a letter, or most likely somebody writing a letter and just adding something for people at home.
Katrina, the reporting of all of this is very interesting because, I mean, the iconic photograph, I suppose, is the one on the front page of the Daily Mirror of the troops, some of them wearing each other's hats, all this kind of stuff, and all of them standing in a row, and this photograph is taken. But there weren't reporters at the front at this stage, and getting genuine news back was very difficult. So this is something that might have been ignored by the British press.
Yes, it wasn't reported immediately. There was, I believe, an embargo that was broken first by the New York Times on New Year's Eve 1914, and then British papers subsequently followed the breaking of that embargo with various first-hand accounts and editorials. And as you say, you refer to the famous photograph of British and German troops mingling.
Which was in January.
That was on around about the 8th of January, published in the Mirror. So there was disapproval from the British government, of course. There had to be official disapproval, and there was felt that this was a regretful thing to have been reported, these moments of fraternisation, and very, very quickly the press got back to reporting battles and perceived to be barbaric behaviour by the German enemy that fuelled a sense of right and justice in the British and Irish cause.
Katrina, Paul has suggested that the reason why this has become mythologised and romanticised to the extent that it has is because of our need, our desire to extract crumbs of comfort from anything. Is that how you see the memorialisation of the Christmas truce?
Absolutely. But there is a danger in sanitisation, and that is what the commemoration of the First World War is doing, and this sense of trying to find common ground in a conflict that really was about bloody enmity between belligerent European powers.
And this is where myth runs up against history, because you cannot ignore the appalling carnage of that war, of those days, of days either side of that war. And if you look at the stories that were appearing in the newspapers right beside that story of the truce when it happened, for example, what was happening on Christmas Day on the Eastern Front, where the Russian and German armies were locked in stalemate, and you see stories of no man's land strewn with the bodies of dead soldiers and men who fought for both armies, some of them lying on the ground at impossible angles, others caught and propped against the barbed wire, bodies half buried and rotting in craters, others lying in the mucks, slowly rotting themselves. And you can wrap this up any way you want, and you can present the truce as some sort of an extraordinary moment of humanity, but all around it was brutality and carnage.
This is, you know, one day, perhaps 2 days at most, in a calendar of 4.5 years of conflict. Let's keep it in perspective. It's not to deny that moments of fraternisation happened, but the bloodshed continued the following day and continued for another 4 years. And that's really what I think we should be remembering.
Right, Katrina and Paul, thank you very much indeed for joining us, Katrina Pennell and Paul Rouse. And let's hear how the song plays out about the Christmas truce in 1914.
And in the morning all the guns boomed in the rain, and we killed them and they killed us again. At night they charged, we fought them hand to hand, and I killed the lad that sang in no man's land. Oh, silent night, no cannons roar. A king is born of peace forevermore. All's calm, all's bright, all brothers hand in hand. And that young soldier sings, while the song of peace still rings, though the captains and all the kings build no man's land. Sleep in heavenly peace.
Welcome back. Children's letters to Santa are usually sent straight to the man himself, who keeps them in his archive at the North Pole. In the files of the Public Record Office, though, of Northern Ireland, there's a letter to Santa that dates from 1933, written by an 8-year-old boy. It offers a unique insight into the experience of the poor of Belfast at that time. Lorcan Clancy spoke to Georgina Larrigy, who discovered the historic letter.
In the Public Records Office in Belfast, among the letters sent to the Lord Mayor, there's a seasonal plea for help that stands out from all the others.
Dear Santa Claus, I would have written sooner, but Mammy had no ink and she says it's rude to write with pencil.
It's included in the files of the Belfast Corporation, which contain letters of distress written in the 1930s. This was a time of severe hardship for many residents of the city.
Letters of children are really interesting. We don't have them very often in history. It's so rare to get the voice of the child themselves and to actually get a letter written by a child and specifically written to Santa Claus. I don't think I've ever come across it before.
Georgina Larrigy discovered the letter to Santa while researching the history of poverty and poor relief in Belfast.
It definitely tugged on my heartstrings when I came across it in the archive. I think the security guards thought I was a bit bonkers when I went up to them and went, oh, look, and I found a Santa letter. But like all Santa letters, he actually asks for some presents. But unlike Santa letters of today, the presents that he asks for are really practical.
I would like a school bag and a pair of boots. Wee Thomas wants the same. Brendan wants boots and an engine.
He asks for a school bag and some boots. As the older brother, and I'm the oldest child in my family, the older child tends to write on behalf of younger children who may not yet be able to write. As well as asking for his brothers, he's also asking on behalf of his parents as well. His father, he said, is an ex-serviceman.
Daddy is in the hospital over a year now, and he only wants a pipe. He was a soldier at the war, but the war men did not give him a pension, so he have to live on outdoor relief.
Of course, Santa Claus keeps his own archive at the North Pole, full of letters from children all over the world. So how did this letter end up in the files of the Belfast Corporation?
I don't think Santa sent it to the Lord Mayor, thinking that the Lord Mayor would be able to do something for this family more than he could. I think what's likely is that the mother, on maybe reading her son's letter to Santa, decided instead of posting it to Santa, that she would post it to the Lord Mayor.
Daddy has not worked for over 7 years and a half. Mammy was a cook for the soldiers at the war. She needs shoes. I saw her mending hers with a bit of an old belt.
The boy wrote from Hartley Street, a road that has since disappeared in the redevelopment of Belfast.
It was a mixed community street, so there were Protestants and Catholics living on the street. And the surname of the family and the child who wrote the letter, and I'm not going to reveal it, but the majority of those with that surname in Antrim and Down at that time, they tended to be Protestant rather than Catholic. And our perception is that Catholics were living in greater poverty in Northern Ireland following partition, but there was a huge amount of poverty within the Protestant community as well.
If you know of anyone who has any old history books to give away, I would like some, as I'm going to be a missionary when I'm big.
So he's also painting a picture of being a good Christian family and a good boy. So he's speaking to Santa Claus, I've been a good boy this year and I think I deserve a present. But equally, if it's being targeted more directly to the Lord Mayor, it's going into this whole idea of the deserving poor, being Christian, being respectable, seeking an education, doing everything they can to help themselves, but just being hampered by the circumstances that they find themselves in. I think it's definitely written by a child. There's too much of a child in it to doubt that a child was involved in writing it. But equally, for an 8-year-old child, it's very strategic. It tugs at the heartstrings. It tugged at my heartstrings. Maybe I'm being a bit soft in thinking that it is a genuine letter, but I do think there was a child involved somewhere. And I do think there was an adult involved somewhere. But in what proportion, etc., it's just really, really difficult to know.
I'm nearly 8. Thomas is nearly 6, and Brendan is 3.5. If you have not enough money for all, I will do without the school bag, as Daddy needs his smoke.
Regardless of whether or not it was written by a child, from an emotional point of view at least, the mother, if she wrote it, would have expected that this would tug on the heartstrings.
I am not a very good writer as I need new glasses, but the master says I am a good scholar. My nib is bad. I hope you can read this. Love to you from Bill, Thomas and Brendan.
Lorcan Clancy reporting there on a letter to Santa from 1933, discovered by Jordina Larrigy in the files of the Public Record Office of Northern Ireland. This year, the Society of the St. Vincent de Paul celebrates 170 years of fighting poverty in Ireland. And now, at this time of giving, we thought we'd reflect on the work of this dynamic charity, set up just before the famine, as Louise Denver reports.
A group of men, 11 men, came together just behind the forecourts in a street called Charles Street of a December evening and started the society. It had been started in France in 1833.
From France to Ireland, the St. Vincent de Paul grew at a rapid pace. On that quiet street in Dublin, a society was born that would change the lives of countless people in Ireland over the next 170 years. Columba Faulkner is the National Secretary of the Society.
A number of them were lawyers, as was the founder of the Society in France, Frederick Osnam. And one of them was John O'Connell, son of Daniel O'Connell. So there was a connection there between Daniel O'Connell, who was a lawyer, and the lawyer in France through a bishop in France.
Described as middle class, the founders of the Society in Ireland often donated their own money toward the cause.
And one man was a man called Thomas Willis, and he was a chemist, and he was sent as a medical officer to Kerry at the time.
Willis spent his free times at book sales or at the bedside of the poor.
And the poverty he saw, like, he was just overcome, and he actually was the man who designed a hinged coffin. And the reason for the hinged coffin was people were buried in paupers' graves, so while they put them into the coffin for the ceremony part, once they got to the grave, they just lifted the hinge and dropped the bodies into the pits.
Sliding coffins were a necessity during the famine.
You know, Thackeray described Ireland at the time as the most wretched of all of Europe that he had been in. I think we've kind of forgotten in some ways how awful things were. And a response from the Archbishop of Paris was to collect 6,000 francs and send them for the relief of poverty in Ireland. When you think of now Live Aid and Band Aid and how we give to the developing world now and respond to needs. So at that time, that money came from Europe to the poor of Ireland. Just looking at the minutes of Cork in 1857, they read, "All our energies are directed to the one object of rescuing as many of our fellow creatures as possible from the horrors of starvation." You know, that sentence is, if you think about that, like that's what we see now, isn't it, in famine-stricken countries. In that year in Cork, the society distributed 67,000 loaves of bread and 1,100 bundles of straw. Typhus was rampant, and indeed when Queen Victoria came to Cork, she thought she'd never get out of the place. She was terrified she was going to get typhus. And the society members, at great risk to themselves, continued to go into the homes where typhus was rampant and the people were sick and they could easily have got it.
Over the following years, the St. Vincent de Paul spread across country. They took a holistic approach to aid.
They were visiting a lot of homes where the fathers had been killed in the Crimean War, so young boys weren't going to school. And they bought a plot of land in Mount Brown, which is near Kilmainham, and they set up a very small school. And when that got too big for the number of pupils, they went over to the north side of the city and bought land there, and they started St. Vincent's Orphanage. Then they made sure that they learned to trade while they were in the school. And very often then they'd contact people in the outside world and get the boys fixed up in jobs. And also in Cork, which I thought a lot of men would have gone to the port to try and get work. And they'd sit all night in the cold waiting for the ships to come in. Hopefully they'd get a few bob offloading. And the society again saw that as a need, and they put up a little shed where the men could get a hot meal at night, be warm, could lie down. So I suppose the good thing was that they were always seeking and finding those who are forgotten.
That was Louise Denver reporting there. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul in Ireland, 170 Years of Fighting Poverty, is now available in bookshops. After the break, Christmas movies, from It's a Wonderful Life to the lineup on telly of history films over the festive season. Welcome back. Over the years, the film It's a Wonderful Life has become a Christmas institution. The Frank Capra picture tells the story of a frustrated businessman who's shown by his guardian angel what the world would be like if he'd never been born. Lorcan Clancy took a closer look at a film that's become a staple of the holiday season.
When It's a Wonderful Life opened in 1946, it divided the critics. Some praised its humour and inventiveness, while others considered it simplistic and corny.
A man down on Earth needs our help.
Splendid. Is he sick?
No, worse. He's discouraged. Clarence, you do a good job with George Bailey and you'll get your wings.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Frank Capra later said that he didn't care what the jaded and cynical critics thought. He felt that this was his masterpiece. It was a film for his kind of people, the downtrodden, the disheartened, and the disillusioned. He knew that they'd identify with the film's message that every individual is valuable, as we all impact the world in positive ways.
What is it you want, Barry? You want the moon? Just say the word and I'll throw a lasso around it and pull it down.
Capra's work was extremely popular during the Great Depression of the 1930s. His patriotic and sentimental films showed empathy for the common man during a time of great suffering for many Americans. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1941, 44-year-old Capra quit his successful directing career to enlist in the US Army. His job was to produce a series of morale-boosting films called Why We Fight, documentaries that explained U.S. involvement in the war.
Causes and events leading up to our entry into the war. Well, what are the causes? Why are we Americans on the march?
It's a Wonderful Life was Capra's return to commercial filmmaking after a four-year absence from Hollywood. Even if he wasn't bothered by the negative reviews, he must have been at least a little disappointed by the film's weak performance at the box office. After all, it had all the elements of the classic Capra picture that had been so popular in his heyday.
Mary, I know what I'm going to do tomorrow and the next day and next year and the year after that. I'm shaking the dust of this crummy little town off my feet and I'm going to see the world.
The film tells the story of George Bailey, a man who gives up on his dreams to run the Family Building and Loan Association in his hometown of Bedford Falls. He works to help local people finance their homes while struggling to keep the business afloat.
The money's not here. Well, your money's in Joe's house, that's right next to yours, and in the Kennedy house and Mrs. Maitland's house and 100 others. You're lending them the money to build and then they're going to pay it back to you as best they can. Now, what are you going to do, foreclose on them? We've got to stick together, though. We've got to have faith in each other.
It's the kind of film that the term Capra-esque was invented for, a story of an idealistic individual who has to stand up for his principles against powerful forces. In this case, that's the miserly Mr. Potter, the richest man in Bedford Falls.
Have you put any real pressure on these people of yours to pay those mortgages? Are you running a business or a charity war? Not with my money.
So why did It's a Wonderful Life get such a cool reception? Perhaps it's because Frank Capra's films, so popular during the Great Depression, just weren't as relevant to a thriving post-war America. Audiences had moved on from the director's Capra-esque brand of filmmaking. More cynical viewers labelled his style Capra corn.
Merry Christmas!
Merry Christmas, George!
Merry Christmas, you wonderful old building alone!
Although it was a critical and commercial disappointment in 1946, It's a Wonderful Life later found a new lease of life on television. For many, the film is required viewing during the Christmas season, and re-watching it has become a holiday tradition.
Good idea, Ernie. A toast to my big brother George, the richest man in town.
It seems unbelievable today, but if it wasn't for a fluke of paperwork, the film might not enjoy its status as an iconic Christmas classic. In 1974, an attempt to renew the copyright failed when some papers were misfiled. The film accidentally entered the public domain, which meant that TV stations could frequently show it and pay no royalties to the producers. Though a box office flop on release, it became immensely popular on TV, especially during the holidays, and it was the subject of renewed critical appreciation.
That's right.
Following a Supreme Court ruling in 1993, the original producers regained control of the copyright. From then on, the film wasn't seen quite as frequently on television. Now, it's generally shown just once a year, at Christmas.
Lorcan Clancy reporting there on Frank Capra's 1946 film, It's a Wonderful Life, and how it became a Christmas institution, one that we never seem to tire of. Of course, that's really what Christmas viewing is all about. Lots of old movies, with a few more recent productions thrown in. And Stephen Benedict joins me now to give us an idea of the historical movies on telly this Christmas. Let's start with my particular favourite, the Westerns. What's your highlight here?
Well, there's a number of really good Westerns, and I think probably the greatest one is The Searchers from 1956, John Wayne's.
One of the greatest movies
ever made. That's right. And it's not only you and me will say that. Ask any filmmaker, I mean, ranging from Steven Spielberg to Martin Scorsese, they all worship at the feet of that, at the Monument Valley with John Wayne walking out into the great desert at the end. It's a fantastic image. And its influence is just enormous. I mean, if you look even at George Lucas's Star Wars, that has a similar setup, that the, you know, that the home, they're drawn away from the homestead and they come back to find some burned out and they're all orphaned. There's a brilliant Western, Clint Eastwood's last Western, Unforgiven, which he directed, is taken from a script by a guy called David Webb Peoples. And strangely enough, that movie began life when David Webb Peoples, the screenwriter, walked out of having seen Taxi Driver in 1976 and said, I think it'd be interesting if I tackled the Western genre in a similar fashion, where the hero is very, very dark and very, very troubled. And he originally called the script Whore's Gold, which wasn't a very sellable title, but then it went through a number of transitions and eventually wound up on Clint Eastwood's desk. And then Clint Eastwood sat on it for about 10 years, deciding that he would age into the role to play it. But I think probably the most high-profile Western on television over the Christmas period is Quentin Tarantino's take on the Western, Django Unchained. And I don't think really you have to be a history buff to be concerned about the content and the depiction of the content of this film. It's highly problematic, full of anachronisms. Mm. We can understand his playing modern music on the soundtrack. We can get that. And, but also then Django himself wears these very, very modern sunglasses, which we can take that as well. But, you know, the movie, I think, is set in 1858 and the Ku Klux Klan are very much in evidence already in the film, despite the fact that the Ku Klux Klan were not founded until 1865. Then we start getting into a very murky area. I mean, I think these things matter because we're talking about something as serious as genocide and slavery. And I think you do a great disservice to the memory of what happened. So I'm wondering why on earth Quentin Tarantino decides to rewrite history in that way. And I don't want to sound po-faced, but, you know, the truth of the matter is, if you're going to look at a movie concerning that era in American history, look at 12 Years a Slave.
OK, this year being the centenary of the start of World War One, is there much for people who are interested in the period?
There's a few. Part of the film is set in World War One. It's out of Africa. I think a lot of people will be familiar with it. It's an adaptation of Isaac Dinesen's stroke Karen Blixen's memoir, starring Meryl Streep in an Oscar-nominated performance. The movie, I think, won 7 Oscars in 1985, maybe in 1986. It stars Robert Redford as well as the most American of English pioneers out in Kenya, Dennis Finch Hatton. It also is very important in terms of Irish filmmaking because Josie McAvan, Irish set decorator, won an Academy Award for her work on Out of Africa. Another movie that is set in World War One is Dr. Zhivago, and David Lean's adaptation. People would say somewhat shallow adaptation of Boris Pasternak's Nobel Prize-winning novel.
Maybe but shallow, but long.
It is, yeah, what it lacks in depth, it went for
in width.
But the thing is that I think the way they went in the right direction because they got rid of a lot of the politics in it. Focusing on the love story. But at the same time, I think strangely that they actually did the Soviet authorities a service because by going for the love story, they ignored or overlooked the sheer barbarism of Lenin's five-year plans.
And the closest to come, I suppose, is the Tom Courtney character, who is a nasty piece of work.
That's right. Tom Courtney's character playing Strelnikov, who plays this absolute zealot. The great line that he delivers in the film actually is the personal life is dead in Russia. History has killed it. But I think more modern films and for a family audience would be Steven Spielberg's War Horse, which was out in cinemas a couple of years ago. It is quite intense, I think, for younger children watching.
Quite harrowing.
I think especially for people who love horses. Mm. It is truly shocking. Now, I'm not a huge lover of horses, but even I was moved by the sheer depravity and the inhumane manner. Because the great thing about the film is that it uses in a way the treatment of horses as a metaphor for the inhumanity that was displayed from one person to another in the trenches.
Okay, and World War II then? There are a number of interesting World War II or World War II related films on.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, Casablanca, you were talking about It's a Wonderful Life and Casablanca. I mean, I don't think you need any excuse to watch that film. All you need is a couch and a box of chocolates. Mm. And it is fantastic. As we know, the movie, actually, in fact, was made as a propagandist exercise because Roosevelt wanted to get on side the studios in Hollywood to help him persuade the American public that fighting a war in Europe was a very, very good thing. We've got to understand a certain percentage of Americans, the majority of them, would have been indifferent to what was going on in Europe at the time. So
get our own back at the Japanese, but to hell with Europe.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yes. Another movie that was from the same period, made in 1946, is The Best Years of Our Lives, William Wyler's multi-Oscar winning story about the veterans of World War II. And it's a terrific film. It has influenced anything and everything from The Deer Hunter right through to Saving Private Ryan, visually, in terms of tone, and in terms of the way the characters struggled to reconnect with their lives, which they had lost, obviously, when they went away. Terrific scene in it where Dana Andrews goes out to, he'd served in the US Air Force, and he goes out to literally the graveyard of all the planes, and he goes for this great crane shot. And when the plane is on the ground, it's a crucifix. And the visualization there is a little bit heavy handed, but it's very, very powerful. And I think another movie that people will enjoy watching is a more modern film. It's actually an adaptation of Ian McEwan's bestseller, Atonement.
With our own Saoirse Ronan. And people will think, what's that got to do with the Second World War? But you have that wonderful scene in
Dunkirk. Oh, on the beach. Mm. That's right. And also, there's another Irish connection that was lit by Seamus McGarvey, the cinematographer. And he was Oscar nominated for that scene, for the movie. And that scene, I think, is a brilliant kernelization of the sense that this is the world about to end. You know, when you see men on a beach shooting horses, there's something, the visual, the power of that image. And you've got these guys in carousels singing drunkenly to one another. You're thinking, this really is the end of this is the end of the world here. And the fact that they did it all in one take makes it all the more powerful.
It's an astonishing scene. Okay, moving on quickly to 20th century American history. A number of interesting films lined up.
Yeah, it's always a difficult one because you're looking at, we're talking about history here. At 20th century, there are a number of good, interesting films. The Good Shepherd, especially given the light of what's been revealed about the CIA. Mm. It's directed by Robert De Niro and starring Matt Damon. De Niro appears in it. Alec Baldwin appears in it. Joe Pesci appears in it. And Angelina
really,
Jolie.
Really, really good movie.
Oh, it's a little bit long, but it's really, really good stuff.
To Kill a Mockingbird happens to a fantastic book, but I don't think I've ever seen the movie, believe it or not.
Give it a go.
Yeah, give it a go.
I mean, if only for, I think it's the first appearance that Robert Duvall ever had made on screen. He plays Boo Radley, but it's most famous for Gregory Peck's towering performance as Atticus Finch. I think it is undoubtedly one of the greatest American novels ever written. And it's a really, really good adaptation of it.
And finally, you were talking about Irish history and The Secret of Kells is on.
Yes, The Secret of Kells.
Wonderful animation film.
Fantastic animation. I think it's very important when, you know, animation is very heavily dominated by the American style, which is all CG. And what the directors Tom Moore and Nora Toomey did with this is that they went the traditional route, which is hand-drawn animation. And the movie, it's about Brendan, a young boy who then helps in the creation of the Book of Kells. But the fantastic thing is that we've also got to say it was Oscar nominated. And the thing is, I think one of the reasons why it was Oscar nominated is because when you're watching the film, you can almost feel the emotional connection that the animators had with the characters that they were drawing, because they're literally touching them as they created them.
We'll have the Queen's speech, I suppose, on Christmas Day, but we'll also have the King's speech at some point.
That's the King's speech. And another Oscar winner starring Colin Firth as George VI. But Miles, if you just permit me just to go back to, we were talking about US history, they're showing The Help.
All right.
And I think that's a really interesting examination of segregation. We were talking about how Tarantino addressed slavery, I think, in a very, very irresponsible way. The Help drifts occasionally into a pantomime depiction of characters, but it's really, really good when it focuses on Viola Davis's character, Abilene, because it manages to say something very, very important about racism, because she plays the maid and she spent most of her time caring for white children and she's ripped away from her own kids. And it shows the guilt that would be thrust upon her as a mother, as a parent. And then also you understand the resentment that her children feel towards her mother. And so that is the way that racism as an institution divided its subjects, divided its victims. And I think a movie like The Help is much more informative and helpful to understanding racism and slavery, because it's about reconciliation. And Tarantino's movies are always about revenge and nothing more.
Stephen Benedict, many thanks for giving us that preview of what we can expect on TV this Christmas. When it comes to historical movies, we put the full list of movies on our website.
There's no doubt that the Night of the Big Wind was the biggest storm to affect Ireland over the last 500 years.
The people couldn't stay in their houses. They were falling down on top of them.
A minimum figure of 300 fatalities.
Some of the old people would tell you that the fairies were the cause of the big wind.
The Irish fairies, you tangle with them, and you're dead.
A clip there from a documentary which brings to life a terrifying storm which hit this country in 1839. It's become known as Iha na Gcaoithe Mórda, the Night of the Big Wind. The documentary will be shown on RTE1 on the 6th of January 2015, the very same night this awful storm, the worst that we have on record, hit the country 176 years ago. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Kieran Hickey, lecturer in physical geography at NUI Galway. Kieran, was there any warning? They obviously didn't have the Met Office and forecasts in those days. Any warning that the storm was coming?
Not really. The only thing they would have been monitoring, and most people would have had them from medieval times, would have been a barometer, and they would have been looking to see if there was a big pressure drop taking place, and then that would be the only way to have some indication of a possible storm heading their way. But nothing in the modern context. So it certainly would have come as a big surprise in the sense of the severity of the event. Obviously, in January is winter stormless season anyway, so you would expect gales and storms, but nobody expected what happened on that night.
And what exactly did happen? How bad was it?
It is definitely the worst storm to affect Ireland in the last 300 years, and possibly for much longer. The records show that. What you had was a rapidly deepening depression in the North Atlantic, which tracked across the northwestern tip of Ireland. Now, it was exceptionally deep. If we think about last winter storms, the lowest one got was 955 hectopascals. This storm was estimated at its worst to be at 918 hectopascals, and it was in the low 920s when it crossed close to Ireland. So we're talking about, you know, a huge amount of really strong winds based on the barometric pressure as a result of this particular event. So it came in very fast, but it also left very fast. It was only really causing significant damage for maybe 8 or 9 hours. So quite a rapid moving depression as well.
And what was the scale of the damage? I mean, this was a huge storm which was passing over a country which had a lot of, well, let's just call them jerry-built houses. I know we've got jerry-built houses in the 21st century.
Indeed.
But
if you think about pre-famine Ireland, many people living in very small thatched cottages, even mud-based cottages as well. So they would have been very vulnerable to high winds. It's impossible to know exactly what the fatality level was, but from the work I've carried out on it, the estimated fatalities is at least 500 in Ireland, and probably many more, because, of course, if you suffered a major bone injury in the 1830s, you didn't survive long-term. If you had a spinal injury or a head injury, you probably didn't recover, even if you survived initially for a few weeks or so. So the real truth of the fatalities is probably much, much higher. It also killed over 300 people in the UK as well, so it wasn't just Ireland that was dramatically affected by it. Every parish in Ireland was affected. The records are incredible, because most storms are either the northern half or the southern half, and it's very rare you get the scale of damage being recorded for all over Ireland. Tens of thousands of cottages and houses were destroyed, and other buildings as well.
And are there anecdotal accounts of what it was like for individual people? Did people actually leave accounts behind? Did they write down what happened to them?
They did indeed. There's plenty of material actually on the storm itself, wrote from a physical perspective and from a folklore perspective. The typical descriptions, particularly in the western half of Ireland, was that nobody was able to stand up, which, we think about a modern day gale or storm, even if you're pushing against the wind, you lean over a bit against the wind, you can keep going. It seems impossible for many people to stand up, and there are loads of stories of people crawling around on all fours and going to try and help neighbours whose houses had collapsed by crawling to speak to them. And the only way you could speak to somebody, because the wind was so strong, was you actually had to hold each other and scream into each other's ears. And they were very worried about children being blown away, so they were putting them in all sorts of containers as well, including things like pots and baskets and even chests, and putting stones over them in some sort of attempt to stop the children being blown away. So it gives you an idea that the scale of the wind and the severity of the wind was incredible.
Yeah, and it occurred on the Feast of the Epiphany, the 6th of January. Did people
Indeed.
Feel that it was a significant date?
Indeed, there's lots of obviously angles, and some of them you can say quite humorously. Of course, it's Little Christmas, it's the Christmas of the women, so it's their fault this major event occurred. Or more importantly, though, from a religious perspective, traditionally in Ireland it was believed that the end of the world would come on January the 6th. So to have a major storm like this on January the 6th was also seen as very, very scary for many people, obviously, who would have had very limited education as well. But also there are all sorts of interesting folklore stuff about the last time the fairies were in Ireland. Ireland, a battle of the fairies. It was the noise of the fairies leaving Ireland. So all sorts of interesting folklore that, you know, predates the famine and predates a lot of, I suppose, modern Ireland in that sense. So it's really a time capsule almost of a different Ireland.
Now, in this era of severe climate change, could it happen again?
Of course, yes, indeed. The recurrence interval of a storm like this is probably 1 to 500 years, or 1 to 300, maybe even 1 to 1,000 years. So it's very hard to know exactly, because these rare events occur so infrequently, it's impossible to get a handle on how often they occur. But certainly, yes, it could could reoccur again. But obviously the outcome would be very, very different, because we would be forewarned. People live in different style houses. They're much more protected. There would still be lots of damage and destruction, and probably would be some fatalities as well, but certainly nothing on the scale of what was seen in 1839. I think the documentary is going to really give people an insight into this extraordinary event that took place.
And it will be screened on RTE1 Television and BBC2 Northern Ireland on the 6th of January. Yes,
indeed, the 176th anniversary. And remarkably, of course, last winter when we had the storms, we also had a major storm on January the 6th in 2014. So it does really bring it back into focus.
And we put the details on our website of the screening, and you can also podcast the programme while you're there. Kieran Hickey, many thanks for joining
Thank
us
you.
This evening. Just want to, before we go, to mention the next History Ireland Hedge School on Tuesday the 30th of December at the Little Museum of Dublin. It's called Braveheart and 800 Years of Oppression, How Scotland and Ireland Grew Differently as Nations. It's hosted by History Ireland editor Tommy Graham and a panel of academics and well-known faces, and all are welcome. Next Sunday, we'll be looking back at the events of 1914, one of the most significant years in modern Irish history. Until then, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Yeti Redmond, goodbye and have a very happy and peaceful Christmas.